Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio TV personality. Dedicated to empowering others through her mental skills, she also features authors and experts from all over the world to share their knowledge and experience with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna and her guests. Here's Donna.
Hello, this is Donna Sebo, and welcome to an hour of mind power, where today we're going to be talking about history. Yes, we're going to be talking about U.S. history, and we're going to be talking to a person who participated in the creation of history, as so many record books are speaking about today. And for those of you of the younger generation, this I think you will find interesting. My guest today is Leon Cooper. His publication is The War in the Pacific, a retrospective by him as an individual. Why? Because he feels like he has something to share that's important for all of us as American citizens. And for those of you who are listening at different parts of the world, it's a touch of history that he himself, in particular, experienced. Leon, welcome to the show.
Many thanks for an opportunity to talk to you and your listeners, Donna.
Now, Leon, I have a number of relatives who fought in World War II. In fact,
I didn't know there was anybody else.
Oh, yes. And like so many, they're often very hesitant to discuss their experiences, Leon. Why is it that you felt that it was important for you to tell your story? Because you've been an inventor. You have invented a product that's used by commercial airlines for testing the fire alarm systems. You are the CEO of your own computer company. You've been a CFO of major corporations. Why? Why did you want to do this?
Well, for a long time, I wrestled with my conscience. And as you pointed out, those of us who have been in combat in any war, recent or a long time ago, don't like to talk about it because it rekindles old, often painful memories.
Yes.
But I felt, after all these years, I needed to say something about my experiences during the war in the Pacific. I was in six major battles. And quite frankly, I saw firsthand what I regarded as the incredible incompetence of the area commanders who are responsible for decisions having to do with attacking certain Japanese strongholds. And I felt that it's about time that, at least from my standpoint, the truth and facts came out regarding some battles. Indeed, I chose to write about five in which I personally took part, and my responsibilities were a landing craft officer for the Navy, and my job was to bring assault troops into the islands where the Japanese had major strongholds. One of the things that dawned on me after my first few battle experiences, we always made direct frontal assaults onto these islands, and the Japanese knew that we so much lacked in imagination, so they were prepared to deal effectively with us. They were very good at killing Americans. Of course, it made their job that much easier. When they knew exactly what our strategy or tactics were going to be in each of the invasions that we were involved in. So each one was a direct frontal assault. And after the two or three of these, as I mentioned earlier, I was in six, it dawned on me, even in my limited military experience, that surely there ought to be a better way of dealing with this, that is, invading an island instead of doing exactly the same thing each time. We lacked imagination. The Japanese relied upon our dearth or lack of imagination, so they were very good at killing a lot of us. That was one of the major things that came out of this. Even in my youthful experience, I couldn't help but think that we were incredibly stupid to have allowed the Japanese to anticipate every one of our moves.
Leon, you have a number of different quotes in your book, and I'm going to start off with actually the very first sentence that you have. You say, "The author and many others probably owe our lives to the pilots shown in the photograph, which you used on your front cover." It's a photograph taken on a carrier. And you said, "These pilots from the aircraft carrier, the USS Lexington, are celebrating their victory over a flight of Japanese planes they had destroyed in aerial combat. And the Japanese planes based in the nearby Marshall Islands had been en route to Tarawa to bomb and strafe the landing forces. They were intercepted by the Lexington pilots just as they neared Tarawa. None of the planes got through, and you were the landing craft naval officer leading a wave of Higgins boats carrying more than 100 Marines onto the beaches of Betio in Tarawa on the first day of that battle." Now, I think what is significant, Leon, and some of my listeners may say, "Donna, this is so far removed from so much of the subject matter that you typically have on your show." And I have to add my own personal side to this, having had relatives that were in the Second World War, one who is now in his middle 80s, who was in Italy, and he was the only survivor of his battalion. Then I know of other relatives that ran the boats up filled with soldiers, just like you were doing, and the scars that they have. And war, I don't care what side you're fighting on, it's ugly, it's nasty, it's horrible, it's absolutely unbelievable stuff. The people carry scars for years. But you have in your book, Leon, and correct me if I mispronounce it, because I'm not familiar with this gentleman. I have not been a student of war tactics, but Thucydides. You gave a quote out of the Peloponnesian War, and I want to share it with my listeners. "Of the events of the war, I have not ventured to speak from any chance information, nor according to any notion of my own. I have described nothing but what I either saw myself or learned from others, of whom I made the most careful and particular inquiry. But if he who deserves to have before his eyes a true picture of the events which have happened, and of the like events which may be expected to happen hereafter in the order of human things, shall pronounce what I have written to be useful, then I shall be satisfied." Now, that was the very first quote in your book, which I think speaks loudly to your positioning.
So glad you mentioned that. Thucydides was, of course, the guy who not only wrote about the Peloponnesian Wars, that was the war essentially between Sparta and Greece. Sparta and Athens, Athenians overreached themselves, foolishly thinking that they could best the Spartans in the war. So Thucydides, my model, I'm hardly in his class, really one of the really great historians of all time. He wrote the Peloponnesian Wars not only as a historian, but more important, just in my case, as one who actually participated. So he and I, if I may put myself in his distinguished company, he and I saw firsthand the events that we described, not as historians, but as participants in the battles that we write about, which gives an entirely different perspective on the Pacific War, and indeed any war where participants write about what they saw. Just as Thucydides wrote about what he saw, I wrote about what I saw and personally experienced. And there's no substitute for the real thing, however that corny that may sound as a commercial, but indeed I attempted to emulate the great historian Thucydides, thinking that I had something useful and important to say that may guide historians who talk about the Pacific War, or indeed any war. There's nothing that substitutes for the actual experience of being there.
Now, Leon, something that I had a conversation about just recently, and your book, The War in the Pacific, we'll talk about FDR a little bit and some other things. What I have heard said by many of the military personnel that are in their 80s and a little bit older, that they had an oath of silence that they were sworn to, many of them. They feel like it's important to speak out today because they're so concerned. I mean, here we are as a nation involved in a war that so many people are just very much against. So much information is coming out today that has been hidden for a long time. There's tremendous disillusionment. In a war, I don't know that anybody ever wins, to be perfectly frank, because there's such tremendous loss on all sides, on so many levels. But you as a soldier, you as a man of honor and tremendous integrity, you have written this because you wanted the truth to be known from your perspective. As a soldier, at the time when you were coming into your awareness of really what the realities of war are, and you can watch all the movies in the world, but you don't know until you have bullets whizzing around you, or today they've got bombs and they've got these missiles and everything else. I mean, whether you were a Spartan fighting, you know, for your country that had been trained in such a way, it's still a brutal, brutal reality. I don't care what generation you're in. For you, how did this change your life and your thinking?
Well, it turned me for a while after my experience into a very cynical, worse and pessimistic person. I came out of the war feeling as if mankind was a total disaster, that nothing could possibly save us. I've matured, hopefully, a good deal since then, so I guess you might call me eternal optimist, that great heroine in South Pacific, the nurse. So I'm not a cockeyed optimist, but at least I feel that there's so much in the human animal that is worthy, even though some of us disappointments to ourselves as was to those around us.
You bring out some fascinating information, and again, right at the beginning of your book, FDR, there is so much information that's coming out about FDR relative to his awareness of so many points of information. I mean, the Japanese have been preparing for war for years. There was security that had been relayed to the President of the United States, the military leaders, regarding upcoming events. You really had a lot to say about FDR because you just, again, being that guy that was out in the action and being aware of many things, do you think history would ever be changed? Your book, your publication, brings out a lot of information, but do you think that there will ever be a time when the history books will tell the truth?
FDR is generally regarded, and I concur, with one of the really great presidents in the history of our country, but his dealings with General MacArthur are, to me, an absolute disappointment. I have still a high regard for him. It was his ego combined with the monstrous ego of General MacArthur that led to a decision by FDR to overrule the Joint Chiefs of Staff and side with MacArthur in the invasion of the Philippines. The Joint Chiefs of Staff had decided early in the war that it was not necessary to invade the Philippines in order to defeat Japan. But FDR, when he decided to run for his fourth term, he knew that all the Roosevelt haters back home were going to push for MacArthur to compete with him for the presidency. And FDR, with his ego, couldn't possibly consider anyone else, not even MacArthur, great God MacArthur, to be suitable to serve in the office of president. And of course, MacArthur, who had no regard for the soldiers under his command, all he wanted to do was to demonstrate out of some feeling of loyalty to the Filipinos that he was going to return. So there were hundreds of thousands of guys who were casualties in the invasion of the Philippines, mainly because FDR decided that he didn't want to compete with MacArthur for the presidency. It really boils down to that very simple question. Two egos, unfortunately, MacArthur's was the greater of the two, and so there were thousands of guys who lost their lives in battles in the Philippines that really had nothing whatsoever to do with defeating Japan.
Now, there was, to my surprise, recently I became aware of the fact that the Japanese had designed a phenomenal ship, and the Americans were able to destroy it, but it was the largest ship that had ever been built, and I'm trying to recall the type of warship it was. But the Japanese had really a tremendous, tremendous capacity for growth and development, and their Navy had been very successful in 1905 at defeating the Russian fleet in the Tsushima Strait.
Yes.
And there's so much history, I think, that when we can go back and we can have material like yours and other people that say, this is what happened, this is where I was, this is what went on. And when we're able to look at all of these little bits and pieces, which usually comes in hindsight, it's very seldom that it comes in foresight. And when you get that, you just go, wow, didn't somebody pay attention to this? And this is dealing with the Russians. I mean, this was going on in that part of the world that it was just amazing what they had accomplished. So these people were intelligent. They are intelligent people. Why we seem to think that they were stupid is beyond me. But it was always that desire for more power. It is something that I don't know is ever going to be taken out of the essence of mankind. Maybe one day there will be that point of wisdom that everyone attains eventually. But it seems to me like there's always someone out there that wants to go to war, take something that isn't theirs from someone else and saying, now it's mine. History is loaded with stories like this. But it was in the 1930s that the Japanese began the conquest of the island group. Now, you have photocopies in your book of all types of documents and notes and points of information where people ever wanted to check this out, they would be able to do it. Tell us about the Combined Fleet Top Secret Operational Order that was issued in 1941.
Well, that was the great Japanese Admiral Yamamoto who issued what you just said. Incidentally, I want to commend you, Donna, for having carefully read and understood my book. I'm very pleased and delighted that you took the time from your busy schedule to read my book, which I spent a lot of time writing and rewriting and rewriting again. But getting back to Yamamoto, he was the architect of the of all having to do with the Battle of the Pacific, including the attack on Pearl Harbor. But a strange thing, as I read his top secret general battle plan number one, as you said, he did not say anything at all about the attack on Pearl Harbor. And my guess is that he didn't trust anybody. He didn't want anybody on his immediate staff to know that he had designs on attacking Pearl Harbor. But he talked in great detail about all the contingencies having to do with defeating United States, Japan, and Holland. So everything is covered in great detail, but not a word about the attack on Pearl Harbor. strange thing. So here was the great Yamamoto not trusting his own immediate staff, so he sprang the attack on Pearl Harbor only by confiding in a few of his most trusted friends and colleagues.
What
a strange thing, isn't it?
Fascinating, and I didn't have a clue about this. And again, we're dealing with a different time. We're looking back in time, and there would be people today that would say, why is this important? Because I feel whenever we are aware that there are those individuals who are never going to be satisfied with what they have. They always want to, again, take from someone else. They don't care who. I mean, it's just, but they're deliberate. And that's what came through in your book so quickly, that, one, America wasn't expected to fight back over things, and that they wanted to acquire all of Asia, and it was the Russians that prevented Japan from taking over all of Asia, and they expected that they were also going to be able to take over Australia and New Zealand, and that one blew me away. I mean,
indeed,
that just wasn't even in my thinking.
Indeed.
So you bring out these details, and I go, that is incredible. But again, you've got photocopies of documents. Of course, I need a magnifying glass when I look at them, but it is fascinating. And your photos throughout your book, it's just incredible. And I think it even meant more to me, Leon, because I was back on the East Coast about 2 weeks ago, and I had the opportunity to be in the Mariners Museum in Virginia. And there is so much history that is there that gives you an idea of the physicality of the carriers and torpedoes and all of these various things. And it makes you aware that this was very, very real. Of course, I know this from, again, as I mentioned, members of my family, the stories that they tell people like you that I've had the opportunity to interact with. This is so significant. You go through a number of different points of information, how we could have been prepared, the things that we needed to do, the information about the different battles that went on, and you give the amounts of the casualties. There are so many people involved, Leon, when it comes to a war. The majority is silent. The majority are those soldiers that are on the land or on the sea or in the air, those soldiers, that they're just going out and they're doing the dirty work. My words, of course. But there are so many people behind the scenes that are interacting and making decisions without a clue of what's going on out in the real field of action. Do you ever think that there's going to be some kind of change with that? Because it's very tough when there is a civilian that has never, ever seen a situation of the blood and guts of war, the horrors of it. I mean, there's just no way to even describe it. I don't know how many movies you think you can watch or how graphic they try to make it. Do you think there will ever be that communication? Look at what we've got going on right now.
Yeah, you would think that we would have learned something from our history, that wars have a way of developing, as others have said, unintended consequences. Surely there cannot be any better illustration of an unintended consequence than this foolish war we've been in for over 4 years, longer than World War II. Fortunately, it was not the casualty count that we had in World War II, but all these kids out there in Iraq fighting people they cannot identify as enemies. They may be anybody. So there's a psychological shock involved in wars where you can't really be sure who your enemy is. It may be that kid sitting on top of a rooftop making a hand signal to a guy who's going to set off an IED.
Mm-hmm.
However foolish they may sound, I at least had the advantage of knowing who my enemy was, when where he was, so that I could know what steps I could take to defend myself, or alternatively, unfortunately, also to kill him before he killed me.
Mm-hmm.
So you'd think that we would have learned something. Unfortunately, we seem to be a warlike nation. All the wars that we've been in our history, with only a few that I think can be identified as justified or proper and necessary, whereas other wars, we, except for the three that I'm sure your listeners know, the three that I'm talking about, but the ones that in between are the ones where you'd think that we would have understood that wars have a way of developing scenarios that were completely unexpected and unanticipated, which is why we're in the disastrous muddle that they're in now.
You bring out a point, just to complement what you're saying, that in World War II, after the firebombing of Dresden, Churchill made the public statement of saying, we've got to make the enemy burn and bleed in every way. And Britain, oh, it was hit so hard. It was just hit terribly. But you make a comment, and I'm quoting directly from your book, that the attacks would also prove to have a disastrous effect upon Great Britain, not to mention the United States. What one source, the quote was, the British Bomber Command lost 55,573 of their air crews, representing Britain's most able and technologically proficient men. This was an even greater slaughter of the nation's elite than the British had endured during the First World War. I think that anyone who would be willing to pick up your book and read it would be willing to become a student of history. There would be a greater understanding about how, yes, we must defend ourselves, but the thinking behind the war, the thinking that is put into place, is it really worth it? If so, how do we do it in the most expedient way possible? Because, again, a war, as I said, I don't know that anybody ever really wins in a war, but a lot of lives are lost. And just as in your statement, as you give a quote of an individual, the most elite, the most intelligent, frequently are the ones that are sacrificed for this. It's a very difficult conversation to have, and I think, Leon, you probably have had some pretty heated conversations with a lot of people. But I think your book, The War in the Pacific, is a good one. And I think it's taken a lot of courage on your part to be able to put it down into black and white so that it would stand as a testament to those of us who are younger than you. Think twice before you put on the armor. Think twice before you turn over the power of authority to someone. Think twice about who is really behind the decision-making. It's quite a challenge, Leon.
I'm so pleased to hear your very perceptive and intelligent comments. I'm showing a degree of awareness that I wish most Americans have that you demonstrate, and I'm especially pleased and gratified that you, as I said earlier, that you took the time from your busy schedule to read and understand what I was trying to say in my little book. Incidentally, my book is a finalist in the Independent Publishers Association category for the history classification. And I'm very happy about that, and I'm especially pleased to hear your comments. You are a remarkable gal, Donna. I want you to know how much I value your feelings about what I was trying to get across in my book.
Well, Leon, I want people to know that they can go to your website, warinpacific.net. That's warinpacific.net. And for those of you, again, who are regular listeners to the show, you may think it's a little bit odd, but stop and think about something. We have the 4th of July coming up. It's a celebration of Americans fighting for their independence against those that they felt were keeping them as slaves. They wanted to be free. Freedom does not come without sacrifice. There's always a price to be paid There's no such thing as free lunch in the experience of life. But when you can read about what has happened in the past, and when you see and you hear about things that are going on in the world today, the Leon Coopers are people you should listen to, hear what they have to say, because they have walked the walk. They have not just talked the talk. And many of them who have been of that silent generation, because of the code of honor that they had and of the dedication they had to freedom and to this nation, it's very, very important. But also, too, it takes courage to be able to talk about what was wrong and what we need to remember so that we should not repeat the mistake again. Leon, I want to thank you again for being my guest. Your book is The War in the Pacific, a Retrospective. And Carl Woodring, former chairman of Department of English, Columbia University, and U.S. Naval officer veteran of the Pacific War, said, "Nobody interested in the 1942 to 45 war in the Pacific should neglect this book, which asks vital questions about rivalries, about lessons not learned, and about dependence on the unreliable B-29. Leon, thank you for being my guest today.
I might. Donna, the book is on sale at all major bookstores. You might... Your listeners might want to know that, $14.95. Can I say one thing briefly, Donna?
Go right ahead.
A documentary is being put together in connection with my return to my first battle called The Return to Tarawa. That was my first battle experience. And the documentary is being narrated by Ed Harris, a movie great. And my editor is a guy who won an Emmy for his documentary on the making of Apocalypse Now. And it'll come out within a few months, so your listeners might be interested in looking for the documentary Return to Tarawa, the Leon Cooper story, in which I talk about things dealing with the aftermath of Tarawa, things that are very shocking to me, and no doubt to you and your listeners. When the documentary comes out, we'll show things that represent the shame and disgrace of our nation for having failed to honor the memory of those guys who fell in the Battle of Tarawa.
Leon, thank you again for being my guest. This is Donna Sebo, my guest, Leon Cooper, The War in the Pacific. A movie will be coming out about it. We'll keep you informed. Donna Sebo here. We're taking a break. Don't you go away now.
All right.
Hello, this is Dr. Richard Petty, the author of Healing, Meaning, and Purpose, and creator of the RichardGPettyND.com website. I am thrilled and delighted to tell you that starting February 7th, 2008, at 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern, I'm going to be joining my friend Donna Sebo on her show on BBSRadio.com. We're going to do this every month, and I can guarantee you that we're going to be sharing new information and new concepts that will astonish and inspire you. Hello, this is Dr. Richard Petty, the author of Healing, Meaning, and Purpose, and creator of the RichardGPettyND.com website. I am thrilled and delighted to tell you that starting February 7th, 2008, at 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern, I'm going to be joining my friend Donna Sebo on her show on BBSRadio.com. We're going to do this every month, and I can guarantee you that we're going to be sharing new information and new concepts that will astonish and inspire you.
Do you want to lose weight? Do you deal with diabetes, high blood pressure, osteoporosis, or chronic pain? Do you want to know one of Dr. Perricone's 7 secrets to beauty, health, and longevity? Do you have 15 minutes a day to look and feel better? Then let me introduce you to TTAP, the workout that works. For the beginner or expert exerciser, learn from physical training specialist Teresa Tapp how, in just 15 minutes a day, you can burn fat and sugar, build strong bones and muscles, and lose inches fast with no equipment or jumping. Visit the TTAP website, TTAP.com, or call 1-800-342-0717 to learn how. That's TTAPP.com. We'll help you lose inches, look good, and feel fabulous at T-Tap.
If you're searching for the perfect gift for a child, consider God's Kiss by Donna Sebo. That's right. Donna is not only a mental practitioner and psychic, she's an author as well. God's Kiss beckons all children and the young at heart to enter the dream world of a little traveler named Johnny. You can order your book today by sending a check or money order to Mrs. Sebo's Classics, Post Office Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington 98497. That's Post Office Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington 98497. If you'd like both the book and cassette, you pay only $19.95 plus applicable tax and shipping charges. This is the book for your favorite child of any age. Donna Sebo's God's Kiss is about a child's sense of place in the world, and it's destined to be a children's classic. Order now. Call 1-800-872-8852. That's 1-800-872-8852. God's Kiss is written by Donna Sebo and illustrated by Ed Gedrose. Buy it today. 1-800-872-8852.
Hi, this is Donna Sebo, and I was just talking with Don, who is running all of the equipment behind the scenes, and it's so important for me, and I was sharing this with Don. Leon Cooper is one of millions that was involved with so many aspects of defending this country, and here we have a holiday coming up, and all of us are going to be out enjoying barbecuing, and it's a day off, and it's wonderful. But I really feel from the bottom of my heart that it's so important to respect and to honor the sacrifices, the dedications, the commitments that people made so that we today are able to enjoy freedoms. And it's very, very important for us to realize that there is a necessity for us to honor that. Otherwise, our freedoms are going to go away. And it's so easy when we become fearful to tell someone else how to run our lives and say, oh, well, you just take care of it. You go ahead and you do it. I don't want to be responsible. When our children are taught that, we have something that is then devoid of those aspects of courage, integrity, perseverance, self-reliance, ingenuity that we need to support and encourage. So if you think I'm passionate about this, I am. And again, I've known a number of people from World War II. My grandfather fought in World War I. The stories that they tell, if you really hear them, if you ever take the time to listen, don't ignore them. Take time to spend in a veterans hospital sometime. If they even talk about it, you're going to be lucky. Because as Leon said, it's a very, very difficult thing to do. It's a very emotional thing to do. But I've talked with Vietnam veterans. I have talked with so many people from so many different experiences through my life. And the main thing that I see that they want over and over again is for people to understand why it is so important to cherish, to protect, and to respect the right of freedom, not just for a particular group, but for all people, because it is so very, very precious. And we do have to be alert. We have to be aware. We have to think. We have to educate ourselves. And we have to be willing to speak up and to speak out when it's necessary. But it's important to think. It is important to evaluate. It is important to question. And it's a learned process. I can think back of a time in my life because that part of my raising, of being raised when I was growing up, is that as a female, you weren't supposed to question. You just weren't. That wasn't a woman's place to do, and I'm not that old, for heaven's sakes. But that's how I was indoctrinated. It took me a lot of years to break away from that. It took me a long time to be able to look someone in the eye and to say, I'm sorry, this doesn't make sense. What are your facts? What are you basing your information on? And, you know, this applies not just to government figures. This applies to your life. It is good to question. It is good to examine. Because sometimes people we want to make out to heroes, they may be a hero or a heroine in some respect, but they're still human beings and they can make mistakes. We always are in a capacity of being able to learn and grow. And there isn't a one of us that doesn't stand on the shoulders of those that have gone before us. But it's important, again, to think. It's important to have association with people who think. Not just those that get emotionally rednecked just because that's just the way it is. When you ask people, what are your facts? What are you basing your feelings on? They may not have a clue. Maybe their Aunt Jane didn't like it. We had someone that we knew that had an attitude about a particular group, a cultural group. And I'll never forget, my husband asked this young man, he was in his 20s. This young man was adamantly against such and such. He said, what do you know about him? He said, nothing. He said, well, why do you have this attitude? My grandfather told me. What did your grandfather tell you? Well, this. And his grandfather hadn't told him very much. And he said, well, when was your grandfather born? And, of course, it was in the late 1800s, early 1900s. And by the time this young man got to explaining what his grandfather said, he said, and this individual, my husband asked, he said, what was it? Why do you think you should hate these people? What are you basing this hate on? Finally, the young man stopped and he said, on what my grandfather said. He said, you have not even met anybody from that part of the world. How can you have a hate for something without really understanding it? Well, that's just the way it is. And my husband said, I suggest you find out about these people. So he since has, but this young man has a terrible battle because he was indoctrinated with a hate. And he stays with it. I had a conversation with someone just 2 weeks ago when I was on my trip. They came out with a remark that was about the blacks. Well, let's let the blacks in. I said, excuse me, what are you basing that on? What's your information? They didn't have an answer for me. They couldn't. They didn't have a basis for the answer. You see, so often it's easy to put blame on a group or a thing or something when we don't know what else to do with our minds or our mouths. And it's amazing. I've done it at different points in my life. And when I finally became aware of what I was doing, I was in my 20s, I went, whoa. But I know people that carry hate around inside of them. I've met them. I'm sure you have too. And they don't know what else to do with it. But they wear it like a badge of honor. I've seen what ignorance, fear, and superstition does. Over and over and over again. And it's only when we as individuals are willing to stand and learn, ask questions, and to be aware, is there a possibility for us to move forward into creating change in this world? It's not easy, but we all have an opportunity of doing it. So I'm so pleased to have had Leon as a guest today. I hope you enjoyed him. And if nothing else, his book, The War in the Pacific, gives an insight and perspective from the guy on the ground, a guy who saw things from his particular perspective. Gives us a chance to look at things maybe with a clearer vision than we possibly would have had otherwise. He's a good example of those that are wanting to speak the truth and to bring it out. Doesn't hurt to listen. Doesn't hurt to read. Doesn't hurt to learn and to grow. But that's what we have to do if we want to make this world that we live in, a better place. This is Donna Sebo. Telephone lines are open. Give me a buzz if you'd like to chat, 877-876-5227 or 888-815-9756. We're going to take a break and we'll be back right after this.
Are you concerned about nutrition? Do you work hard to eat right, try to feed yourself and your family nutritious foods? Well, you'll want to know about glyconutrients. What are they? These are sugars that are present in nature, however, we're not getting them in our food anymore. Scientific study is proving that these sugars are necessary for all cellular and immune system function. Over 20,000 studies are conducted each year on glycoforms alone. These are the sugar protein structure that line each and every cell of the body. 4 out of the last 8 Nobel Prizes in physiology have been awarded for research in the area of cellular communication and how these sugars work in the body. This is Donna Sebo. Every day I bring to you information that will empower and light up your life. I would like to invite you to visit my website, DelphiInternational.com, and find out more about these glyconutrients. That's DelphiInternational.com. Go to my website, go to the left side of the screen, tap on the button that says glyconutrients. MIT's Technology Review, February 2003, states that glycomics is one of the 10 emerging technologies that will change the world. Education is the key to advancement of understanding and making our lives better. Visit my site, DelphiInternational.com. Go to the left side of the screen and tap on the button that says glyconutrients. I know it'll make a difference for you, as it has for me.
Hi, this is Donna Sebo. Telephone lines are open, and if you'd like to chat with me, I'd be delighted to light up your life with a little bit of intuitive insight. 877-876-5227. That's 877-876-5227. 888-815-9756. That's 888-815-9756. Now, all you need to do, if you're a first-time listener, hey, it's easy. Just give me a buzz, as I said, at either one of those numbers. And all I need from you is your first name or your initial, and then let me do my stuff. After that, you're welcome to ask me about anything that you like. Now, the lineup for this week, even though it is a holiday week, we're going to be talking about a literary genius. This is Hamlin Garland. If you haven't heard of him, I hadn't either. What an amazing man. He had a tremendous impact on the artistic world, and we'll be talking about how he established a lot of what we experience and enjoy today. Keith Newland from Nebraska is going to be with us. We're going to be talking about a life, Hamlin Garland. And then we're going to be talking with Brigadier General Ezel Ware, Jr. He is retired. His book is By Duty Bound, Survival and Redemption in Vietnam. And then also, Unknown Universe, Rich Hammond. We're going to be going into quantum physics, folks. This is going to be interesting stuff. Rich Hammond is a fascinating man. 4th of July is on Friday, and I know so many of you are going to be enjoying a fabulous holiday weekend. Well, I hope you have a chance to tune in. It's going to be an open mic day, so we're going to be talking about all kinds of different things. So that is the lineup, and the listing of guests will be coming out in my newsletter, which will be coming out on Tuesday and Wednesday. So if you'd like to get your free copy, just email me your email address, or you can go to my website, and within 48 hours after it's put up, then we have it online on my site, so you'll be able to access it. So my list of guests will be there. Also, the listing will be on my listing at bbsradio.com. And don't forget, if you are interested in any of the shows, we have the archives available for you, and at any time, at your convenience, you can go in and listen to those programs that perhaps that you missed. We want to make sure that they are available to you when, again, ever you want to go in and review them. So that's the lineup for this coming week. And I am always so pleased to be able to talk about young people and to be able to share what some guys in my neck of the woods in the Seattle, Washington area have done. And it's Stuart, Travis, and Cole. Now, I've got a photo of them in front of me, and these are guys. They're in their shorts and T-shirts, and this is a picture of them in Newport Beach, and it is a picture that you would not believe. They have got skeins of yarn scattered all around them, and they're wearing caps that they've knitted. These guys are knitters. Now, Some of you may say, Donna, what's the big deal? These are three young men that took upon themselves an opportunity. They decided that they were going to knit. Now, how did this all start? What happened here? You don't usually see men knitting. Now, Drosy Greer was unusual. He did needlepoint. He was one of the first guys that a lot of to-do was made over. You know, here's this great big guy, Drosy Greer, doing needlepoint for relaxation. But interestingly enough, men have always been, on multiple levels, involved in the clothing industry and the design industry. I mean, that's a fact. But generally, women are the ones that typically will be busy crocheting and knitting and doing that kind of stuff. You don't see too many guys sitting around and doing that. Well, Park is a young man who was caught by his brother crocheting. And his brother said, you know what? This is really fun, and it's so easy for me to do. Well, Stuart and Travis and Cole decided they were going to do it. They got so excited about it. They made their own little beanie caps, and they really liked doing this along with their skateboarding and their surfing whenever they had the chance. And they said, all right, we've made all these little hats. They got so excited. They used all kinds of yarn. They bought all kinds of colors. And they were making all these little beanies. Well, one of the guys, Trav, said, you know, we've got all these beanies. Why don't we take them to school and sell them? So they took what they had to school. They sell it. They sold out. 30 additional orders came in on the very first day. Then they started getting special requests. Well, we want this with a beanie. We want that with a beanie. And you can imagine where that came from. So what did the guys do? They got better at what they were doing. Did more and more beanies. Well, they earned the nickname, the Crochet Kids. And crochet is spelled with a K. Well, they get through high school. After they graduate, they all went to different schools. One went to the UW, and the other, two of the others went to Vanguard in California. Well, they kept up their crocheting, but obviously their classes were going to take priority. Well, Cole ended up going into the Dominican Republic. This was part of his education. He was going to go there to teach English and math. And then Trav went to an orphanage in Bali, and Stu worked for a nonprofit in Uganda. How are these three young men? They're in different points in the world. And he said volunteering in these areas really opened their eyes. And when they all came home, they were in Spokane, Washington, and they said, you know what? We got to do something for these people. These people are just not even able to make a decent life for themselves. So Stu came up, and Travis and Cole agreed that they were going to teach women in Uganda to crochet. Now, there had been a 20-year civil war that finally was coming to a close. Most of the women had lost the husbands and the men in the family and were raising children alone. So they decided they were going to register Crochet Kids International as a nonprofit, drew up the business. They took it to Uganda, and the women were able to start making a living because of doing this. They were eager to learn. They couldn't figure out why these Caucasian guys were sitting there teaching them how to crochet. But the women were skilled. They did it. And do you know what? Today, Crochet Kids International is a recognized nonprofit. All three of these young men work very hard to encourage a cycle of empowerment and awareness. And when they think about what they did, how it all started because one of their brothers was crocheting, they're really amazed. From such tiny beginnings, the women that they've been teaching in other countries how to do this, they're able to find a way out of poverty. And he said, I like to think we learn as much from them as they're learning from us about the power of humans to pull ourselves out of any situation as long as there is hope. surf-loving guides can change lives halfway around the world, one stitch at a time. This is Donna Sebo. We'll be back same time, same place, right here at bbsradio.com. Remember always, you're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. This is Donna Sebo. Enjoy your freedom. Others have fought for it. Honor them. In your own manner, so that future generations can enjoy it as well. Bye for now. Talk with you tomorrow.
You have been listening to The Donna Sebo Show. If you would like a copy of today's broadcast, send $10 to The Donna Sebo Show, P.O. Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497-0272. Be sure to put the date of the broadcast in your request. If you are not able to be a part of today's program, join Donna and her guests Monday through Friday, and she will be here to take your calls. Thank you for listening and being part of our program. Have a wonderful day.